The fact that a community is required to achieve great feats was an idea that the Buddha had 2,500 years ago. It is not a modern concept. This community that is required for everyone to be part of and then move forward as a mission with a vision, that is not a recent idea. It's not a modern idea. The Buddha, in all his wisdom, he knew how essential that was, and that is why he created the community of the Sangha. And that is how, since then, right from the great elders of Sariputta, Mahamoggallana, Kashyapa, Ananda, Nanda, Rahula, and so on, our forefathers, the great men and women who walked the surface of the earth, when they listened to the Dhamma and they understood that there was a philosophy that brought them happiness, they all walked up to the Buddha or to his disciples and they asked to be bestowed with the opportunity to be part of that community. So the Buddha gave them a vision, but the mission was their own to achieve. The Buddhas can only show the way. It is down to each and every one of us to walk that path. But it is not easy to do it by oneself. Because as you know, and we all know this well, it's far easy to see the weaknesses of the others, but it's very difficult to see our own, isn't it? And that is why when a community comes together, we all achieve great success. But that community has to have some very special characteristics. They have to care about each other as much as they care about oneself. See, that doesn't happen unless you find a philosophy that helps you to stop thinking about oneself and start thinking about the greater picture. It cannot work with selfishness. If there was ever a community where the people in the community, the individuals in the community always tried to be number one. They wanted to be the best. Even at the expense of others, such a community would not thrive. It will always perish. Because always there's going to be conflict in there. There's always going to be competition there. When the Sangha community was established 2,500 years ago by the Lord Buddha, none of them wanted to be number one. None of them. Perhaps things might have changed today. That's a pity, if it has. Perhaps today they have lost the essence of what the community of the Sangha is. Perhaps. But then back then, that was not so. Because people did not come into the sasana looking for anything other than happiness. Anything other than to achieve a happiness that comes through selfless loving, compassion, loving kindness, and so on. I'm delighted to announce that this is a community in my heart that represents the bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, upasaka and upasika that the Buddha wanted back then. And for that, each and every one of you must take credit. See, we've been doing sermons since the middle of last year, and today I was reminded that this was the 50th sermon. I'm not surprised one bit that there are still among ourselves those who've not come forward and said not one word. Swaminasa, do you know that it is I who organized this? Swaminasa, do you know that it is I who do the arrangements, to do the decorations? Swaminasa, do you know that it is I who bring the refreshments? None have come forward. None has come forward and said, it is I who do this, it is I who do that. Whenever I hear you walk up to me and speak to me about what you have achieved here, you're always going on about how the Rajakirians, how we as a community have been able to do this. You deserve every credit for that. And that is the hallmark. That is the hallmark of your journey to Nibbana. The more one thinks about oneself, the less that one can think about, the greater good for themselves. But as you start understanding the Dhamma, you cross that barrier, you cross that bridge of self-centered thinking, and you start thinking about the greater good for all. Today we have grown as a community. Look around and see how many faces are here today. Almost every week we have a new face. And you know what's even greater? We never ask you what religion you are. We never ask you what faith you're from. What your belief system is. Whether you're rich or you're poor. We never ask you what your education level is. We don't care. We never have and we never will, because we understand one thing. That is everyone. Everyone in that list that I just mentioned, they all look for something. And that one something is the something that we all need. And that is happiness in heart. A peace of mind. And that is why we have all come here. So there's one question we might ask you as you walk through these gates. Are you looking for happiness? If the answer is yes, please walk in. No other parameter, no other measure, no other characteristic is of any importance to any of us. Don't you all agree with me? Well, that is that community that we have created here. It's wonderful. I'm not easily impressed. That much I can say. But what we have been able to achieve here, when we started, I think we had a much smaller gathering. I never think of you as my followers, because it is not true. You are followers of the truth. I'm not the truth. You are followers of the truth, just as I am. This is why last week I reminded you, I'm not your hero. I want you to consider yourselves to be your heroes. I'm only here to remind you that if one man can do it, so can you all. Because sometimes we need someone to look up to. Not to revere them, not to respect them necessarily, but to remind ourselves that it is still possible. I'm so glad and I'm so grateful that the Mahasangha still exists to this day. That when you step outside and you drive past, there are still temples along the way. I picked up a habit from one of my Kalyanamitras many moons ago, when I first ordained. This was a habit that I observed in one of my fellow monks 6 years ago. I observed him and I thought, wow, incredible. See, the things that we pick up from people. And I've done it since that day. You know what that is? How would you? I haven't told you what it is yet. When we drive past, whenever I see a temple, whenever I see a Buddha statue, I bring my hands together and I chant a sadhukara, sometimes even silently. Because my fellow monk, who was my brother back then, not my blood brother, but my brother in my monkhood, we were fellow monks, I saw him doing that. And then I asked him why he did that. And then he gave me an answer that I was blown away by. He said, how much effort goes into making something like this? Brick by brick? How many people must come together to create something like this, a marvel like this? Creating a Buddha statue is no easy task. We've had our hand in one or two at the monastery, so we know that it's no easy task. It's no easy task to build a temple out of nothing. To build a place where people can come and become virtuous, become good men and women, and practice the Dhamma is no easy task. You know, right from getting the approvals, to clear the lands, to building the place, to finding people to come and support with that cause, to find the right kind of people. It's no easy task. So how much effort goes into building up such a place? Tremendous effort. Sometimes it takes years to do something like that. But when someone has already done the hard work, when someone else has already done the hard work, we are simply left with the easy task of rejoicing in the goodness that others have created into this world. So all you have to do is look at it and rejoice. When the Jetavanarama was offered, you know the story, to Anathapindika who offered the arama, of course he earned some merits out of it. But then there was a man who observed this and chanted a sadhukara. He just looked at the goodness that was done to this world and he said, he thought to himself, wonderful, how great. The mere fact that people think that something like this can be done in this world and people come together to do something of this kind. And then he chanted a sadhukara. And the rewards that he achieved were far greater. We are not concerned about the rewards necessarily, but just the thought, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I give a sadhukara to the thought. Just the thought that someone had. Why don't we build a temple here? Why don't we build a statue here? So that from here on, for many years to come, men, women, children, people from all walks of life, as they walk past this, when you see a Buddha statue, does that not bring you a moment of peace? When you drive past a temple and you see the pagoda, when you see a Buddha statue looking outside, standing out there or sat in a samadhi posture, does it not bring you a moment of respite, a moment of solace? But that was no easy task. It's like bringing up a child. Parents in the room will know how difficult it is to bring up a child. But then they grow up to become adults and then they go on to do great things. And then a lot of people can rejoice in that. A lot of people can benefit from that. But just imagine the effort that has gone into bringing that child up. Starting with the 9 months that the mother had to endure all that pain. And then after bringing that child into this world, to look after it, to take care of it, to protect it from its enemies, both physical and psychological. And to educate the child and to feed it and all that. Teach it good values. It's no easy task, is it? In the same way, this is a habit that my fellow monk taught me. And then from there on, to this day, as I see any temple, I see a Buddha statue, I always bring my hands together. Whenever we leave the school on a Sunday, there's a Buddha statue waiting just right outside. As you open the gates and we drive outside, there's a Buddha statue waiting right outside. What an opportunity to rejoice. Someone's had a thought to do it. What we have achieved here is something similar. This has been done over the last 50 odd weeks. A lot of people have come together to make this a success. This all started, as I related the story to you 1 or 2 weeks ago. It all started when we were looking for a place. It had to be a place that was fitting for what we wanted to do. So we asked around, and nothing comes cheap these days, of course, as you know, particularly somewhere like this. A place that was reliable, a place that was safe, a place in which we could attract the right kind of audience, people who would come in and to actually listen to the Dhamma. I mean, anyone is welcome, but there are some who might not come in for the right reasons. Let's just put it that way. You're all here for the right reason. You're all here because you want your salvation. But the wrong kind of place can attract the wrong kind of people. So as we were looking for a place like that, word got out. And the chairman, sir, of this organization, who we are so happy to have here today with us, as he got to hear that we were looking for this, for a venue for this, he sent a word saying, I'm happy to offer my school. So we had a meeting. He personally walked me around the school, brought me into this hall and said, Swaminathan, this is our main hall. Would this do? I thought, you know, about 10 people will come for a sermon. I said, would this do? This would more than do. I expected a classroom. And he offered us his main hall. I mean, just as we walked into this into these premises, I realized, you know, this is a fitting place for it. It was very clean, tidy. That's the kind of place I like to be. That's the kind of person I am. These are the values that my parents have taught me. If you are somewhere, make it a place that leaves a good impression on others. You know, my father always taught me there are three ways in which you can leave a place. One, you can leave it worse than you found it. Yes? Have you not seen that? How people leave a place worse than they find it? Ever bothered going into a public washroom? Why don't you even want to do it? You know, sometimes you'd rather hold it in rather than go to a public washroom. And there are many other places like that, because people come somewhere, you know, they make use of the facilities. They don't realize the impact that they're going to have if they leave that place untidy. They don't realize that what you give is what you get. People don't realize that, because they are blind to the Dhamma. If everyone knew that, they would always leave a place spick and span. But most of the time, people leave a place worse than they found it. Second kind of people, they leave that place just as they found it. So if the room was untidy, they leave it untidy. If the chairs were strewn everywhere, they'd leave it like that. If they find a toilet that has not been mopped, not been wiped, they'd leave it like that. But they haven't done any worse, but they leave it just as they found it. They're okay. Not terrible. Okay. The first kind, I wouldn't touch them with a barge pole. Second kind, okay, you can just about live with them. But there are great people in this world. They always leave something, how? Better than they find it. What did the Buddha do? Answer. What did the Buddha do? He came into this world and he left it far better than he found it. Great man. What did Jesus Christ do? He left the world far better than he found it. There you go. Great man. That's the kind of people I like to associate with. Because if you associate with greatness, you can aspire to greatness. My teacher always tells me, pay any price to be in the presence of extraordinary people. Pay any price. Don't cut corners there. Don't be penny wise and pound foolish. It makes no sense to do that. If you have been presented with the opportunity to be among extraordinary men and women, pay absolutely any price for that. If you have to stay up late, do that. If you have to burn the midnight oil, do that. If you have to work extra hours, do that. If you have to go an extra weekend, do that. I'm here today because I followed that advice. I always put myself where I have the opportunity to associate with extraordinary people. That's why I'm here on Sunday mornings. I come here to associate with extraordinary people. People who are willing to give themselves up so freely, without a bat of an eyelid. You want this? Take this. You're here to do good to everyone? Fine, take it. Oh, by the way, we have a car park as well, free to use. What else can we... How else can we be of service, Swami Mahansa? No, sir, that's enough. We were just looking for a classroom to accommodate 10 people for a sermon. Incredible. And the same goes for all of you. Look at all the decorations that have been done here. You know, there may be people who come here who are impressed by what they see before they're impressed by what they hear. We take photographs of these things. I get to see what's behind me on a photograph, generally speaking, because I come worship the Buddha and I come and sit here. I enjoy, I observe the offerings you have made to the Buddha, But then I come and see her, and then someone shows me the photographs at the end of the occasion, sermon. And then, wow, I rejoice in them. But you know, these photographs, they get shared. News of this sermon, it goes out there. And then people look at that and people think, I want to go there. Have you never driven past maybe a place of religious worship where you've seen a big stupa or maybe a Buddha statue or a Samadhi statue or whatever, and you thought, let's stop there for a moment? You know, some people, they're impressed by what they see before they are impressed by what they hear. That's okay. That's okay. You know, yesterday we had an event at the monastery. We call it the Ranaviru Panchanisansa Mahapuja. You've attended several of the Panchanisansa Puja at the monastery. So we did one particularly and especially for our heroes, our war heroes. So this was for the armed forces. So the chief of staff, the defense chief of staff, he visited us at the monastery, and he wanted to bring his staff to the monastery so that they could earn some merits and also listen to what we had to say. Just as you, they are no different. Everyone's looking for one thing alone, and that is the path to happiness. That's it. I always say, we are not here to spread a religion. I hope you know that. If you don't, then where have you been the last 50 sermons? Unless you've been here, right, plugging your ears with something, if you've heard every word I've been saying, you must understand that this is not about a religion. This is about a philosophy. So he got to hear about what we are about, and then he brought his staff yesterday to the monastery. And then that event was organized for them. When we had the first meeting with the gentleman, he said, Swaminathan sir, I was in the Dhamma hall as the monks walked in, followed by the Anagarikas and the Anagarika Mahatmyas, followed by the children. And this was before any conversation we had had. So he'd just come in as a visitor. And he said, you know, Swaminathan sir, there was one thing that I was so impressed by. So we were wondering what he was going to say. Maybe we see the Buddha statue. Is it the monks in their robes? What is it? Had you listened to a sermon? He said, Swaminathan sir, I was impressed by how your people walk in lockstep. You know, one foot after the other. Every left foot together, every right foot together. He said, this kind of discipline we see in the army. But to give this kind of discipline, we use... we use lots of love and care. How do you manage to do that at the monastery? Even the little ones? Because there are two ways in which you can discipline someone. You can beat discipline into them, or you can give them the Dhamma. To this day, we've been doing it right from the start. Because when we first started our monastery, there was just 10 of us monks and a few Anagarika Mahatas back then who were wanting to become monks soon enough. So we got together and we started to set down our vision. We discussed a few things. How are we going to create a place that's going to be a paradise for everyone? 6 years ago this. I mean, the blueprints were laid down way before that. But all that changed. Anything that we thought we could do, we couldn't do after we arrived in Sri Lanka. Because we were far away from reality. You know, the first plan we drew for the monastery, it looked like this. So we did this around a coffee table. This was the entrance. Okay? Now you laugh when I say this. Do try and control yourselves, okay? Then we had Kuti. We had some more Kuti. These were for the monks. And these were for the nuns. All in one perimeter. That was the blueprint we drew around a coffee table. And we thought, why not? What's the deal? We're all here for salvation. So why does it matter whether you're a man or a woman? Because we read in the Tripitaka, right, of an incident, events that had happened 2,500 years ago, and we thought things were just the same to this day. But little did we know that times had changed. And of course, you know, we were in the UK, so, you know, we were influenced by that way of thinking, where, you know, everyone gets every opportunity the same. And we wanted everyone to have the presence of Guru Hamduru at the monastery, so that the ladies could have equal access to our teacher. But as soon as we arrived in Sri Lanka and started looking for a land and started to set down the way we were going to do things, we got told a few things. We learned our lessons. So this part of the monastery had to shift. Not next door, almost a kilometer away. So that is where we have the Anagarika Arami today. Initially they were going to be nuns, but that didn't work out quite the way we planned it either. For reasons I'm not going to go into any detail right now. But one thing still stood the test of time. And all, despite all these challenges, I'm so proud to say that to this day, our purpose, the objective of what we want to do, we have been so successful in achieving. Men, women, children, from all walks of life, they have today been able to come and find paradise on earth. I can say this from the bottom of my heart, because I know what it's like to be home. I know what it's like. You, of all people, will know that I have any opportunity to go if this is not the right place for me, right? I've spent enough time outside of our country, of Sri Lanka. I can find a home anywhere. This is not me boasting about myself, this is me boasting about our monastery and the community that we have built there. If it's education, I've had it. If it's professional success, I've had that. If it's financial success, I've had that. If it's a good family, I've had that. None of those things I've not had. I've had it to the best that anyone could hope for. But I'm still here. This is home now because this is where my heart is. That is why I always keep inviting you. Come and taste what paradise is like. But I think you are beginning to experience that now, because you are beginning to take the Dhamma on. And the Dhamma is beginning to make an impact in your lives. And I think this, what you have offered to the Swami Nuhase today, in your own writing, I believe, is a testimony to that. But none of this would have been possible if not for the community that you are. The community that we have built and the community that have come together to make this dream a reality for many more than just yourselves. I cherish that. I honor that and I respect that. As I was speaking to the gentleman, the chairman said this morning, I was saying this is like what we have done here is similar to what his father had done, the late Mr. Ellis. He was the founder of DSN Anaika College, as you may know. When they started the school, they wanted to create a Budukuti, as all good Buddhist schools would have, a shrine room, so that Buddhist children could go and worship. But his father had a different plan in mind. He wanted to be inclusive, not exclusive. In fact, we were talking about why people see religion as a separator, a divider, rather than something that unites people. And it's such a shame that religion has become that. But what his father wanted to do at the time was to create a school where children from all religions didn't feel like their religion was an obstacle to getting a good education. Should it be? What do you think? Should religion be an obstacle to getting a good education? Should religion be an obstacle to being fed? Should religion be an obstacle to having a good mother or a father? No. These are meaningless dividers. Meaningless. Something that has been gifted to all mankind to unite has today been used to divide, which is such a shame. So what the late Mr. Ellis did was, there were a lot of challenges back then. I've read the biography. And then he walked up to the president back then and sought his permission to establish within the school places of worship for children of all religions. And that still stands today. So children of all religions, as they walk into the school, they can go and pay their respects to whatever religion, whatever faith thereof. And I was sharing with the gentleman, we've done something similar here. Here, we have people who consider themselves Buddhists. Here, we have people who are Catholics. Here, we have Muslims. Here, we have Hindus. Here, we may have Jews. Because we don't see that division. So you can ignore everything I just said and replace it with this one line. Here we have human beings who wish to be happy. That's it. Remark well how some people come into this world and leave it a better place than they find it. That's the kind of people we want to be around. Today you have the Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen. This is why I always tell you, please protect yourselves. Keep yourselves safe. Don't take unnecessary risks. Have I not been asking you to be careful? Those days when I used to cross the street, if I used to see an old granny, I'd put myself in front of her and help her cross the street. Nowadays, I don't do that. Even before I became a monk, I said, Achyama, can you stand in front of me and keep me safe as I cross the street? You know, I have the Dhamma to give. That is why it's important. I have the Dhamma to give. You have the Dhamma to give. How many people are here today because of you? There are many people here who have come along, not because of me, but you invited them. Many of you walk up to me and say, Swaminasa, I'm here because of that gentleman over there. Another one comes and says, ma'am, Swaminasa, I'm here because of that lady over there. Swaminasa, I'm here because of my cousin who first came to listen to the sermons and he brought me along. Swaminasa, I'm here because of that gentleman over there. He works with me. And he invited me to come along. So I just came here for the sandwiches, but now I've decided to stay because of the Dhamma. Have they not left this world a better place? You know, the impact you have on this world, ladies and gentlemen, does not have to be grand. Okay? It doesn't have to be grand. A little difference can go a long way. If you can change one heart, if you can heal one heart, if you can mend one mind, that is more than enough. If we, having come into this world, can improve this world by developing one human being, changing one heart, healing one mind, that in itself would be a success story, a life well lived. As parents in this room, you have ample opportunity to do that. As teachers in this room, you have ample opportunity to do that. So, let's continue this mission. I believe I'm on a mission. I don't know for how long I can carry on doing this because the forces of nature are against me. I have come here with a body, a human body that can break at any moment. You know, I've been talking to you a couple of weeks ago, or 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's a risk that we take coming here. But we do it because we want to make an impact on your lives. That is a very small example. This morning, ladies and gentlemen, three of our monks and two Anagarika Mahatayas, they set off. You know where to? Jaffna. To give them the gift of the Dhamma. they're our friends. No one was more impressed by that than the officers that came in yesterday. The armed forces, officers from the Triforces, no one was more impressed by the story than them. They said, "Swaminathan sir, how great, what a fantastic opportunity for us to reunite with our brothers." Because they have started to listen to the Dhamma and they realize that this Dhamma is here to unite, to bring people together, not to divide. And they know that the war was simply a war. They fought because they had to fight, not because they wanted to fight. They didn't want to fight, they had to fight. So once the war ended, that was it, right? Now the war is finished, you and I, we are brothers. They have been looking for a way to mend those relationships. They've been looking for a way to pay their debts. And now they've come across the Dhamma. So this morning they set forth. I think it's going to take them about between 8 and 10 hours. It takes me 1.5 hours to get here. But those three monks and two Anagarik Mahatyas, they're on the road now for 8 long hours on the way to Jaffna. Anything could happen, right? But they're willing to do that. Willing to go and see someone they'd never met in their lives. Willing to go and see not their family, not their father or their mother, not their brothers or their sisters. You know, normally people would get on a flight or catch a train to go and see their loved ones. Yeah? Yes, well, so did the monks. They went to see their loved ones. And who are those loved ones? Fellow human beings. So the real war is only just beginning. A war of peace. A war of harmony. A war of unity. A war of freedom. And then the Swaminathans who are now, right now in Australia. Again, you know, these are a few examples, and I'm only talking about the monks that I know because these are the monks that I live with, but think about the rest of the world. You know, right as we speak, there will be monks, nuns, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis traveling, you know, over the skies, on the seas, in vehicles, carrying the gift of Dhamma throughout the world. Marvelous, isn't it? This is what the Mahasangha is supposed to do. To leave the world a better place. Better than they find it. And you are all the same. Let's all resolve to leave this world better than we found it. Whenever I finish writing on the board, I always erase the board. It is to give an example to the young children in this room. I don't want to leave it like this. Because then I've left it worse than I found it. Haven't I? Yes, you can't do that. You have to at least leave it as you found it. Because I can't leave it better than I found it. Little things. If ever you walk into a washroom and you see there's water on the floor, don't walk out without making a little bit of a difference. Because it's the attitude that you have. It's not like it makes no change, it makes no difference. It makes a difference, ladies and gentlemen, because it makes a difference within. On occasions, at the monastery, as you know, every 3 or 4 months we have a blood donation campaign. I've seen something our Swaminathans do, and I'm very impressed by that. When the nurses ask them to lay down on the beds to draw blood, they take their napkins and they put it where they put your feet, and they put the napkin there before they put their feet on top. So you ask them, why? Why do you do that, Swaminathan? I don't want to leave it worse than I found it. Because someone else will also have to come and put their feet there. And I don't want them to be putting their feet where I've left mine. If I leave my footprints there, Don't want that. Because what if my feet are dirty? I don't want to leave it dirtier than I found it. See, people who are doing little things to leave the world a better place than we found it. Little things. If you see a piece of paper, pick it up. Does it matter whether it's your place or someone else's place? If you ignore the fact that this is someone's place, is the whole world not our place? So if you see a bit of litter on the floor, we can pick it up, can't we? I saw this last week. At the end of last week's sermon, we were in the other hall as we walked down, and the little child was holding the umbrella for me. And as I walked in, so he walked me up to the car, and I said, "Buddha." And I pointed to him a bit of paper on the ground. He said, "Someone else, yes, yes, yes." As soon as he sat me down in the car, he ran away as fast as his little legs could carry him. And he picked up that piece of paper. He put it in his pocket. Don't you think he earned merits out of that? Even if you choose to ignore the merits, do you see the impact that it's had on him? Is he not a better man for having done that? Think about the attitudes that he's developed within himself. That's a gentleman, isn't it? That's what makes a gentleman. Not just being suited and booted. Anyone can do that. You can put a coat on a dog. But a gentleman is made. They're not born. They're made. A gentle monk is who I wish to be. Among gentlemen, we can be gentle monks. Ladies and gentlemen. So there's a lot of things that are going on here. This is not just the Dhamma. That's why I say, to create a community, we need the Dhamma and then some. It's all that together. It's the fact that you always clean this room before you leave, even that. It's the fact that you put the chairs back where you found them, even that. It's the fact that you clean the washrooms before you leave it because you want to leave it at least as you found it. Have you ever spotted these washrooms dirty when you walked into the school? Never. Not in my experience. They've always been spick and span. Always. That's the kind of place I like to be. It's the kind of people I like to associate with. These are little things maybe, but little things tell a big story. Because behind the scenes, there's a lot going on. So even if you can bring your children here just to see this community, just to spend half a day with this community, that does them a lot of good. Maybe even better than sending them to piano lessons on a Sunday morning. Just being among good people. You are the average of the five people you associate with. This is what my mentor taught me. 6 years ago, when I started working at a bank, my mentor, I found a great mentor. I've always been so fortunate in coming across the best teachers in life. I don't know how that works out, but my lucky stars have always been guided me to the best teachers. So I came across a mentor. He picked me up and he said, "Right, I'm going to help you develop. You must do everything as I say, and you will go on to achieve greatness." So I worked with him for 5 years. He taught me many things I know today. The things that I use today to help run the monastery. Almost 1,000 people walking through our gates every day. And that's a pretty big establishment. Guru Hamdura trusts me to give leadership to that organization. But I didn't come into this world having learned all that. I came into this world and then learned. My parents taught me some things. My friends taught me others. My teachers taught me a great deal of what I know today. My mentors and so on. You teach me things every day. I'm always learning. So my mentor taught me that you are the average of the five people you associate with. So he said, be very careful about who you associate with. If you read the newspaper every morning, remember that that is someone you're associating every day. I used to pick up the metro on the way to work. I stopped doing that. As you get into the tube, they had a free newspaper. Little did I realize that if something's free, then you are the product that's being sold. I didn't realize that until he opened my eyes to it. Now I have a think about why Facebook is free. Nothing against Facebook. I'm just saying. If something's free, then you are the commodity. You can, if you want, take out the ET part. So I stopped reading the newspapers because I realized much of what I was filling into my head first thing in the morning was junk. Rubbish. Most newspapers are filled with trash. Things that belong in the trash can, I was putting into my head. How someone stabbed another person, how two countries are at war. How are those things ever going to make my life better? How someone had raided a bank. How is that going to make my life better? That was the kind of dhamma that I was associating. What if there was a newspaper that only talked about the good things that people do with each other and to and for each other? I have a newspaper like that. See? The good that people do to each other and for each other. You wrote that, right? Yeah. So I stopped reading the newspapers. Then I stopped watching the news. Of course, you know, media will be there because, you know, it's a consumer world. So what you want to watch, they will show you. It's not what you need to watch. It's what you want to watch, they show you. That's the problem. What if TV only showed you what you needed to watch and not what you wanted to watch? Wouldn't that be good? You'd be good, but they wouldn't be able to do a business. They wouldn't be able to run a business like that. So I stopped watching the news. And I thought my whole life would collapse if I didn't watch the news. No, nothing like that happened. Because there were always people either side of me. At the workplace, by the water cooler. They'd fill me in on the details. Then I realized you can run, but you can't hide. But these are the little things that my mentors taught me that changed my life one day at a time, ladies and gentlemen. Then they gave me the books to read. You know, reading a book is such a valuable thing to do. I know this is not the Dhamma. I know that. But these are things that help us to improve our lives. I am here because of the product. I am the product of many years of making. And I'm not complete. I'll be the first to put my hand up and say, I'm probably the most incomplete person here. Because there's a lot more for me to learn and there's a longer journey for me to go. I probably may not be complete even on the day of my passing away. But what I'm saying is, every day I'm in the making. So my mentors gave me the books to read. He said, read these books that were created. These are works of art by men and women who lived life 50 years, 60 years, maybe 70 years, and they've acquired all that knowledge, experience and wisdom. And they have put all that into 100 pages. All you have to do is read the book. Saves you from living 100 years to learn all that experience. Isn't that so? The well-read among you will understand exactly what I mean. But you have to read the right stuff. You have to read the right kind of stuff. Do you fill your head with trash? Or do you fill it with something that is a treasure? Reading is a good habit, as long as you read the right kind of stuff. At our monastery, we have a little library. In that little library of ours, we have books, but they are curated. We don't just get in any old stuff. Every book, this takes time. But every book that passes through our gates and into that library, I have to personally check it and make sure that that is the right kind of book that monks, our anagarikas and anagarikas and our little children are supposed to be reading. Because we are all taking responsibility for their lives, not just a day of entertainment. You know, parents, they come and leave their children at the monastery and say, Swami Nasa. It's like a puppy, Swami Nasa. Feed him, wash him, look after him, teach him, and teach him the values, and make sure that he becomes an arahant, okay? Bye. Before you can even ask him to stop for a cup of tea, they're gone. You know, with so much trust, parents who listen to the Dhamma, they bring their children. So just imagine the responsibility that lay on our shoulders. It is just not to teach them, give them education. It's to ensure that they have a good upbringing and they go on to become great human beings. So every book that gets through our gates, it has to be checked. For things like spreading the Dhamma at the monastery, we use the internet. When we first started, we didn't have any of that. In fact, the reason that that part of the village has internet now is because we have the monastery. They didn't have the internet before then. They didn't even have a paved road before then. And the monastery came and the infrastructure started to come into place. But at the monastery, for spreading the Dhamma, writing magazines, you know, Dhamma articles and so on, we do use the internet. Today I'm grateful to my teachers who taught me networks engineering. That is what I learned at uni. So I learned at uni how to network. Not network with people, that my parents and teachers taught me. But at university I learned how to network devices. A computer network. And am I glad I did that? I never knew back then why I was learning these things. I didn't know why I was learning these things. I didn't know why I was learning leadership skills. Today I do. In fact, I didn't even know why I was learning English. Today I know. You see the German gentleman at the back of the room? One of our anagarikas? I'm so glad that my English teachers taught me English so that I can help my brother in Germany. There are many who connect with these sermons online. In fact, now we do two sermons at the monastery, one on Saturday and one on Sundays. Right? So this sermon is done in English. We always meant to do it in English for an audience who might find it difficult to understand the Dhamma in Sinhalese. Someone told me the other day, Swami Nanda, the Rajagiriya sermons, they get a lot of larger viewership than the sermons you do on Saturdays at the monastery. Almost twice as many views on the internet, on YouTube and so on. So I keep thanking my teachers for teaching me English, teaching me the language. And I thank my teachers for teaching me networks. So at the monastery we have a firewall. If anyone wishes to access a website, it matters not what age they are, how senior they are at the monastery, matters not. Each website I will check. It takes time. Of course it takes time, but all great things take time, don't they? It takes time. Now we have to create videos, we have to create posters, things like that. You know, this poster that's out there that says English Dhamma Talk, that was created at the monastery. So you have to find the artifacts for that, to create it. Then you might have to download a few images off the internet. So if there's a website from which you can download images on the internet, I'll have to check to make sure there is only the right kind of stuff that's on there. Because I've spent a fair bit of time on the internet to know that it's not just the good stuff that's on there. It's like the Wild Wild West, right? That's why they call it the WWW. But, you know, the long and short of all that is, this is the community that we have created. It is not one man that's doing all this. It's all of us together. It's you. Today all we can do is give the gift of the Dhamma. But someone has to come and build a Dhamma hall. Yeah. If I had to go and earn a living for myself, where would I have the time to preach the Dhamma? You do that. You will understand the Dhamma, you contemplate on the Dhamma, and you earn a living, you feed your families, and whatever is left, you contribute to the propagation of the Dhamma. You contribute towards charity. You give it so that the Dhamma can be accessed by many. That's your contribution. You think if only we, the bhikkhus, were to do this, any of this would have been possible? How do you think the camera is up there? I didn't bring it when I came into the sasana. I can't afford a camera. I don't have a penny to my name. But someone among you offered it to the sasana. What is the sasana again? The purpose of Nibbana. That's what it is. Sabba papa sakarana, kusala supasampada, sachitta pariyodapana, etam buddhana sasana. So someone offered the camera and thought, for sabba papa sakaranang, I offer this camera. For kusalasa upasampada, I offer this camera. For sachitta pariyodapanang, I offer this camera. And for the Buddha sasana, I offer this camera. That's how they do it. If you offer this pen, how should you do it? The same. If you offer this, the same. If you offer your knowledge, you don't have anything. You don't have a penny to your name, but you have knowledge. You can offer your knowledge. How should you do it? The same. For sabba papa sakaranang, I give you my knowledge. That's why when we do a merit transfer, we not only transfer merit to those who have offered arms, robes, clothes, and food and medicine, but also to those who have passed on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. Don't you think that has a part to play? Just the mere thought that may this be successful. Although we don't see some things, ladies and gentlemen, there are things that go on that we are blind to. Today you understand that we don't see everything out there. Color is a very small spectrum of the entire electromagnetic spectrum, right? There are a lot of things we don't see. But the mere thought that you have, may you be well, may you be successful, may you attain to Nibbana, that has a very profound impact. Something you may not see, but it's there. So this is a collective effort. All of us together, we have done this. And all of us together, we will continue to do this. Till your last breath, ladies and gentlemen, live your life so that you leave this world a better place. Till your last breath. And we don't need to do it so that people will talk about us after we are gone. That's not what we're doing it for. If no one remembers you when you're dead, is that a problem to you? Okay, let me put it this way. People remember you after you're dead. You're happy. Huh? Does it matter? People talk about you after you're gone. Makes you happy? Then why do you care whether they do talk about us or don't talk about us? That's not what we do it for. We do it because it makes us happy right now. That's why we do it. So when I'm gone, this must continue. This must continue. When the good gentleman's gone, this must continue. This must continue. When each and every one of you are gone, your legacy must continue. The legacy is our purpose. In the sasana, the Buddha laid down a rule of discipline. Just think about how compassionate the Buddha is. He laid down a rule of discipline whereby he said, the last bhikkhu to pass away in my sasana passes away by committing an offense. They don't have a choice about it. That's the funny thing. Right? So the last bhikkhu to pass away in the sasana, a bhikkhu is a high ordained monk. The others are called samaneras until you receive your high ordination. The last bhikkhu who passes away in the sasana passes away having committed an offense that they can do nothing about. You know what that offense is? Not creating another student monk. Not bringing another student monk into the sasana who can continue the service of the sasana. That is the offense that he commits on the day that he passes away. He dies having committed that offense. What do you think the Buddha intended to mean by that? What is the spirit of that rule of discipline? Of course, leave a legacy. Even when you are gone, your service has to continue. Didn't the Buddha show that to us by example? He's gone, but his service continues. That's how great men are. They leave the world a better place so that even when they are not here, the good service that they have always wanted to render continues. So among you are great men and women, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm sure you all are. You are good mothers, you are good fathers, you are good brothers, you are good siblings, you are good teachers, you are good citizens of this land, you are good human beings. Leave this world a better place, so that when you are gone, you leave your values, your virtues, the wisdom that you have, with as many people as you possibly can. Spread the seeds far and wide, so that even when you are gone, that goodness will continue to thrive. That goodness will endure. That should be our legacy. That should be our legacy. So may the Dharmishtha Rajagirians live long and prosper, even when you and I are gone. So on this day we celebrate the 50th sermon, the occasion of the 50th sermon, this is what I ask of you. You've asked me to come here 50 times the last year, and I have come every single time without fail. I ask you this in return then. When you are gone, leave your legacy. Live your life so that you leave what you stood for, the great things that you stood for, behind when you are gone. And to do that, you have to spread the seeds. You have to share your wisdom. Let someone know where to find the light and show them the light. Guide them to the light. Hold their hand maybe in the first few days because they may need it. Bring them along. If they choose to turn around and go away and say, this is nonsense, this is rubbish, that's okay. Thank them for their attention. Thank them for giving up some of their time. Maybe today is not their day. You mustn't force them, because then they go away with a bitter taste in their mouth. But even if they walk away, bid them farewell gracefully, so that they'll walk away and remember, you know, even when I walked away and I rejected their offer, they were still graceful towards me. They were still very kind and generous towards me. Maybe I should try another day. People are like that. So that is what I asked of you. Leave your seeds behind. Leave your legacy behind. When you are gone, there has to be another Vidhanarachi. I don't know your surnames. There has to be another Vikramarachi. There has to be another De Silva. There has to be another Kapukotua. Whatever your surnames are, there has to be another one of you. At least another one. At least another one. Yeah? Good. Let's observe the precepts before we continue any further. Right. Let's take a moment to bring our palms together in veneration of the great master. It is his legacy in which today we enjoy the gifts of Dhamma. He is a great teacher, the greatest teacher that we have ever seen, showing the path, leading by example, and leaving a legacy behind, and in his footsteps we follow today. He is the magnificent one, the fully awakened one, the unblemished in character, the perfect one. To his name we make this veneration. As we do so, let us also remind ourselves that this is an opportunity to renew our pledge of allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem. In other words, this is our pledge of allegiance to walk the path of nobleness and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Right. Let's pay a visit to the Dhamma. And discuss, continue our discussion from where we left it. I have a video clip to show you, which I will do at the end before we part. But before that, I want to continue our discussion in the Dhamma. Let's try and remember what we've learned so far. Because this is the Dhamma that helps us to achieve to greatness. Remember, for as long as we are self-centered, how do you know if you're self-centered? As long as you sense a self, you are self-centered. You can't help it. You can try to be altruistic. You can try. In fact, I think someone came up and asked me, Swaminathan, so what about when we do things for others? Is that not selfless? Yes and no at the same time. See, there are two kinds of selflessness. One kind of selflessness is when we think about others because it makes us happy. We are happy when we see that others are happy. It's like a mother, she's happy when she sees her child is happy. So that is where we see a mother's love. A teacher may be happy when he or she sees that her students or his students have achieved great results, good results in their exams. That makes them happy. So when we are happy because someone else is happy, that is one kind of selflessness. It is selflessness nonetheless, I admit. That is the good kind of selflessness. See, there is the bad, there's the good, and there's the... there's the great. What is the biggest obstacle to greatness? Goodness. That is the biggest obstacle to greatness. From here, you jump to good. From bad people going to become good people, good people going to become great people. So the obstacle to becoming good is doing bad things, having bad thoughts. But then to obstacle to become great is having good thoughts. Only in the sasana will you hear this story. Because in the sasana, you have akusal, ping, and kusal. You've heard the two words, ping, punya karma and kusala karma? That's the difference. This is papa karma. Punya karma, kusala karma. There are three levels that we get to observe when you look at it, things from the sasana side of point of view. So there are two kinds of selflessness. This is selfishness in and itself, right? Selfish as selfish can be. They're only thinking about themselves, and at anyone's expense, they're willing to achieve their happiness. Do I need to give you examples of that? No, all you have to do is switch on the TV. Right? Or pick up a newspaper on the way back home. Plenty of examples of how people are willing to sacrifice others on their behalf. Not sacrifice them on others' behalf, sacrifice others on their behalf. You get that a lot. That's why the four great hells are always so full. Ask the Buddha, what proportion of all sentient beings are in the four great hells? He says, this much of grain, the number of grains on my thumb is about the number of sentient beings that remain in the four in the human world, and about the same as the number of grains that make up this earth. That is the quantity of beings. When they die, they go into the four great hells. What are the two in comparison? It's almost like one to infinity, right? No wonder, because you have about 99% of individuals here. It's not that they are bad. Badness is in them. That's why we always love the sinner. We hate the sin. We never hate the sinner. When you go to the dentist with a toothache, what does the dentist do? Does he extract you? Or does he extract the bad tooth? Yeah, so he takes out the badness within you and sends you back home, right? Yeah. Did I tell you about the story of a sculptor? There was once a sculptor. He was working on creating a statue. He was sculpting out a statue out of rock. So he had a chisel in his hand and a hammer, and he was chiseling away. So an observer walks up to him and asks him, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm making a statue." "How do you make the statue?" "Well, I take out everything that is not, and then all you have left is." Yeah. So in this story, he said, I'm making a statue of the Buddha. So he asks, "How do you make a statue of the Buddha?" "I take out everything that is not the Buddha. And what is left is the Buddha." "How do you think that statue was made?" "Well, maybe not that one, but if you had a stone statue, that's how they make it. You take out everything that is not the Buddha." "So how do we make a Buddha out of you then?" "Huh? Take out everything that is not the Buddha. What is left? The Buddha." So if you want to become an Arahant, what must we do? Is there a part that we have to buy from Panchikavatta and come and fit it to you? No, that's not how you become Arahants. You are inbuilt, you have an Arahant. There's an Arahant within each and every one of you. But then there's an Arahant and there's some parts that are not Arahant-ish. So what we do is, we take the chisel, that is the Dhamma, and we take the hammer, that is the sermon, right? And we chisel the Dhamma through the sermon, and we take out all the parts that are not an Arahant about you, and what is left is an Arahant. So you see, I never created the Arahant within you because you are the Arahants. That's not my doing. So please don't give me credit for making an Arahant out of you, okay? I don't do that. You already have the Arahant within you. So you see, when you have, this is papa karma. When the mind goes into vexation, that is basically when the mind wants something. Can you name one occasion where someone's done a bad thing where they never wanted anything? Can you give me one example of something like that? A man does a bad thing because they never wanted anything. Can you? No. Excuse me. Since time immemorial, if man has sinned, it is always because he has wanted something. Yes or no? Yes. If man has sinned, it is always because he has wanted something. So how does someone who doesn't want anything sin? Is that possible? It's not possible. It's impossible for someone who doesn't want anything to sin, because wanting leads to sin. Wanting is another word for desire. It is only desire that leads one to sin. So then if you perhaps, you know, from time to time are worried and concerned about your conduct, that's possible from time to time. That you may question yourself, you may question your conduct, and you might think, why do I still do that? Why do I still have that bad habit? Why do I still have that thing I do? I really want to give up. I don't really want to be doing this, but why do I keep doing it? It's bad of me. It's terrible of me. I don't want to be doing like this. I don't want to be this kind of person. The only reason for that is because you have a wanting somewhere. Your mind wants it. So when the mind wants something, it'll find a way to achieve it. You know the old saying, if there's a will, there's a way. We have now reworded that to, if there's a vexation, there's a way. If there's a vexation in your mind, you will always find a way to achieve it. That is how bad people are made. Bad people aren't born. Remember, within every human being is an Arahant. Is there no Arahant in the bad people? Speak up. Isn't there an Arahant in every bad person? There is, ladies and gentlemen, there is. There's an Arahant, and then there's the bad stuff around them. That's why they show up as bad. They're not bad at the core. They're not bad at the core. They're an Arahant at the core. If you can begin to look at people like this, through this lens, you will begin to have compassion towards all sentient beings. Even the person who comes to hurt you, to harm you, to take away what is treasured by you, if you can simply see that they're only here because they have a wanting and they're vexing right now. That's why they have come to take what is precious to me. Not because they're bad at the core. It's simply because they're an arahant. But that arahant cannot surface because there's a shell around them, a shell of evilness, a shell of badness. That is a wanting, after all. If you can take the wanting away, now you have an arahant. That's how bad people are. So bad people are at the core what? They're good. In fact, they're great. Then you have the good people. So these people are selfish. These people are selfless. They're selfless. But there are two kinds of selflessness, as I was trying to explain. Because they are also selfless. This you might like to think as mundane selflessness. This is the selflessness that goes beyond that. These people are selfless, or at least they appear to be selfless, because pleasing other people pleases them. There may be many among you like that. But that's good, because that is a stepping stone to the next level up. Pleasing other people pleases you. When you see a poor man, right, you drive up along the street and you're at the lights and a beggar walks up to you. Most of you will be willing to give something, spare change. So, when you give it to them, you may look at their face just to see whether they're happy about it. Maybe they have a smile on their face. And that smile puts a smile on your face. Because you're made happy when someone else is happy. That's good, but that's not greatness. Because now your happiness is dependent on their happiness. It is still a step away from unconditional happiness. So a good lady walked up to me last week and she asked me, Swaminarayan sir, in my line of work, my task is to heal other people. Wonderful. My task is to heal other people. But how do I manage my expectations? Because last week we spoke a little bit about expectations. And so the questions that she had was, when I treat them, I expect them to heal. Is that bad? Because we're talking about expectations. So what we discussed and what we explained was there are two kinds of expectations. There's the expectation of my expectation that they should be well. So doing something for my behalf. Then there's an expectation for their behalf, or rather on their behalf. I treat them expecting them to be fine. No expectation on my behalf. Meaning, whether they are healed or not, it does not impact my happiness. I do what needs to be done. An arahant always does what needs to be done. It's a bit like a printer. When you send the print job, it prints. Because that's what a printer is supposed to do. I'm not suggesting one moment that an arahant is like a robot. He's not. An arahant is compassion walking on two legs. That's what an arahant is. He's loving kindness walking on two legs. But they serve because that is what is expected of them. That is what they have to do. But they are never pleased, or they're never made happy by making someone else happy. In other words, let me put it this way. They don't make others happy so that they can be happy. Do you see the distinction between the two? Your mothers love you. No end. If you remember how your mothers doted on you, they cherished you, they loved you, they caressed you, they gave you, showed you their affection. Remember when you ate, what was her reaction? She was happy. What about when you didn't? We've all been there, we know the drill, right? One of the best ways to stress a mother out, to vex her, and to exhaust her, is to refuse your food. Right? Especially when we are young. They have no other business rather than running around us, around the house, running behind us, around the house, trying to feed us. And when we eat, aren't they very happy? So they're happy when they think we are happy. So their happiness is dependent on our happiness. It's good It's not great. When I speak to my mother, I try and explain to her this. I say, Amma, you used to be happy, or you are still happy when I am happy. Now, what if I get a cancer? What if you get to hear that, you know, I got a cancer, right, and I'm dead. I had an accident. What's that going to make you feel? And she said, of course, Swaminarayan, I'm going to feel destroyed. It's going to take away my happiness. I said, let's change that. Because that's not the kind of happiness that you ought to have. Because that happiness is not unconditional happiness. That is good for a mother, but it's not great. So these people, they're selfless, yes, but selfishly selfless. Does that make sense? They're selfishly selfless. Now you go on to the third kind of person, the great people. They don't have a self. They don't sense a self. They don't sense that they are. They just perceive vipaka, and that's all. This sense of self that you and I feel, this sense of self that the person sat next to you is an actual individual, is an entity. The way that you identify that this is my mother, this is my father, this is my wife, this is my husband, this is my boyfriend, girlfriend, in that way an arahant doesn't. Because they don't have a unique identity that they attribute to the Panchaskandha. Because actually that is all there is, the Panchaskandha. There's the Rupaskandha, there's the Vedanaskandha, there's the Sanyaskandha, there's the Sankaraskandha, and there's the Vijnanaskandha. Ladies and gentlemen, that is all there is. There is mind and there is matter. That's all there is. There's energy. That's all there is. I often ask you this question. If two of you living in the same household eat from the same rice pot, at what point does one serving go on to be you and the other serving go on to become your wife? If it's the same rice pot from which you've served yourselves, right? At what point does the rice become your hand and at what point does it become her hand? It's just rice. Yeah? Once you put the rice through your body starts to digest it, it breaks it down into its constituent parts, and then the DNA prescribes how it needs to be reformed. And then according to that blueprint, matter that was just deconstructed is reconstructed. You and I call it wife. So when you hold her hand, what's really going on? Rice against rice. But that's not how you perceive it, right? Isn't every cell of your body what you've eaten? Come on. Isn't every cell of your body you are what you eat. That's the popular saying, right? You are what you eat. So isn't every cell of your body what you've eaten? So what you eat, what you ate, you cooked. What you cooked, you bought from the supermarket, right? So in that case, you should go to the supermarket today and walk down the aisles and say, that's my head, that's my knee, that's my toe, that's my arm. Oh, and that's my wife's arm, that's my wife's head. You don't perceive it that way, do you? But you bring it home, you cut it, you slice it, you dice it, you cook it, then you eat it, and then the following day you say, that's my wife. What's really there is the Panchaskandha. But we perceive it by giving this Panchaskandha a unique identity. These identities, they don't exist in the real world. We perceive them in our minds because our minds are capable of all sorts of illusions. I mean, you dream, don't you? Isn't that evidence enough that you are capable of all sorts of illusions? That alone is evidence of that. When you think of a future, can't you imagine a future? You can imagine things, can't you? You can imagine a future which is very different to today. That has never happened. Isn't that again evidence that you can create whatever you want in your mind? Aren't there times where you wish, you know, if yesterday never happened, if this didn't happen this way, if it had happened that way, then today would have been this way. That you can go back and change events in the past in your mind and then reconstruct a present and then foretell a future. All of this you can do in your mind when no such thing has actually happened in the world. Do you see how much your minds are capable of? Now, if your minds are capable of doing all that, no wonder you take a carrot and call it your wife. Because ultimately that is all she is. A carrot reconfigured. A tomato reconfigured. A potato reconfigured. A pot of rice reconfigured. A fish reconfigured. A piece of chicken reconfigured. Ultimately that's all you eat. Now think about this for a second. I'm going to take a sidetrack. You know, when people talk about caste. No wonder they didn't like the Buddha back then. Because the very things that were woven into the fabric of society, the thorns that were woven into the fabric of society, the Buddha came and started pulling them out. These were the thorns that pricked every man, woman and child. It hurt them no end. But ignorance and attachment would want it that way. So they didn't like the Buddha and what he was doing. He came and asked this very question. If we both eat paddy from the same field, if it's the same thing that goes into making this body and this body, how is it that I am a Brahmin and you are a Shudra? On what grounds do we settle caste? Why is it that when I see you, I have to wash my eyes with milk? As was the custom back then, would you believe me? That was back then. To this day, there are still fragments of that. In some parts of the world, they talk about blacks and whites. What goes into making a black man is the same stuff that goes into making a white man. You don't need the Dhamma for that. Just look at the periodic table, for heaven's sake. All matter is composed of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen and so on. These are the elements that make up all of us. But in our minds we perceive a very different identity. These are all creations of the mind, ladies and gentlemen. They don't truly exist out there. But the problem is this. Once people start perceiving these things, they're helpless. Then you have the bad people. Think about the war that we ended 15 years ago. It was on the grounds of race. Maybe partly religion. Maybe partly culture, language, whatever. They were the so-called Tamils. These were the so-called Sinhalese. We ate the crops that grew on the same land. For heaven's sake, how were we different? We breathed the same air. We bathed in the same sunlight. How are we different? But perceptions create an entirely different reality. Insane, don't you think? This is the insanity that the Buddha comes into this world to heal. The insanity of delusion. Because once delusion strikes, now you start to see entities. Everything that was one, you start to separate and see them as individual bits and pieces. And then you have raga and dvesha, because both raga and dvesha are rooted in moha. Moha is your sense of this separation, your sense of identity, your sense of isolation, separation, uniqueness. And then once that happens, of course, there are some you like to be with, which is raga. There are others you don't want to be with and you want to distance yourself from, which is dvesha. See, raga and dvesha are both based in moha. And you know the price we paid for that. We killed our own brothers. We killed our own brothers. We took away a mind's opportunity to attain Nibbana. That's what we did. That's what we did. A war can never end by fighting. I mentioned this briefly yesterday, but it's worth saying it again. A war can never end by fighting, and the reason for that, ladies and gentlemen, is because every time you war, every time you go to war, every time you fight, every time you pull a trigger, every time you throw a bomb at someone, that is a vipaka, but you are doing the karma again. So what you throw at someone, you are sowing the seeds for another war every time you war. Nothing can be more futile than war. Nothing can be more senseless than war. I'm not trying to take anything away from the war heroes. I'm not taking anything away from them. Yes, they fought for us, they fought for our land, they fought for our nation, they fought for our country. I admit. But once I stop identifying myself as a Sinhalese, when I stop identifying myself as a Tamil, when I stop identifying myself as a Sri Lankan, now I'm simply a Chitta. Aren't I? I'm just a Chitta, I'm just a Panchaskanda, the five aggregates. Now when you look at the situation from that perspective, what a waste that was. How futile that was. How meaningless that was. Because of a fantasy that we created in our minds, we took away real lives. Both parties. They took away these lives, they took away those lives. Ultimately, lives were lost. Theirs and mine were only creations in the mind. Lives were lost. Just imagine if one day your left arm forgot that this is your right arm. Just imagine that situation. Imagine you had a knife in your right arm, okay? And you had another one in your left arm. You forget that both these arms belong to you. Now you see the two arms approaching each other. What do you think the left arm is going to try and do? What do you think the left arm is going to try and do? Fight. Defend itself, won't it? And so it will use its weapon to defend itself. What do you think the right arm is going to do, seeing that the left arm is approaching it? Because it's going to feel threatened, and now they're going to fight each other. Luckily you don't do that, because you know that both these arms belong to you. People war when they forget that they're all part of the same thing. That's when they fight. That's a pity. There's only one remedy for this. That is why those monks are still on the way to Jaffna. There's only one remedy for this. You have to move away from goodness to greatness. Because here's what a good man will do. Listen to me. Here's what a good man will do. He'll fight for his country. Checkmate, ladies and gentlemen, checkmate. The Dhamma is the only way. Bring me the president of this country and I'll explain this to him. Checkmate. Every time you give a command to kill someone, you're reaping the seeds, you're sowing the seeds for another war. And you are going to be the victim of that. Every time you victimize, you will be victimized. Every time you vilify, you will be vilified. Shouldn't these things go into the syllabus? Why do we only teach physics to our children? Why don't we teach them the truth about the world? The truth about existence? Why? Why not? This is not a religion. Do you think I'm teaching you a religion? This is not a religion. This is the science that science is yet to discover. This is the science of the future. Future scientists will talk about this stuff. But until such time comes, people will suffer. Until such times come, people will suffer. That is why the Dhamma is the only remedy. Show me another and I'm prepared to disrobe. See, a good man will fight for his country. He'll pick up a weapon for his country. He will. Because he's loyal to his people. He's loyal to his king. He's loyal to his ruler. He's loyal to his family. A good father is prepared to kill on behalf of his family. A good mother may be prepared to steal so that she can feed her children. And you'll call her a good mother. What she doesn't realize is while she's good to one, she's bad to another. Good and bad are simply two sides of the same coin. From one perspective, they're selfish. From another perspective, they're selfless. But what's selfless? There's an adjective that has to precede that. Selfishly, selfless. Then to be truly selfless, you have to be someone who is selfless. As in, no self. This notion of selflessness that you find in the dictionary is not the selflessness that the Buddha taught. The dictionary definition of selfless is when you care about others. It may or may not say within braces because it makes you happy. That is the true definition of the selflessness that you find in the dictionary. But the selflessness that the Buddha taught was a different kind of selflessness. It is a state of mind where there is no self, so therefore less of self, selfless. Because when you have no self, in other words, what that means is you don't identify yourself as an entity and therefore there is no need to preserve me at your expense. There is no need to preserve one at another's expense. Because they're all the same. Remember what we talked about last week? When you are nobody, you are everybody. When you are no one, you are everyone. Like the atoms that make up this. These atoms don't identify themselves as a pen. That's why these very atoms we can use to make another pen. All you have to do is melt it. Take those atoms, you can make another thing out of it. The food that you eat, the atoms that make up those things, they don't identify themselves as a potato or a tomato. This is why, put through these machines, they can go into make human beings. The same atoms. But our perceptions, they fool us. Because a perception is the only device that can be fooled by ignorance. That's why. You see, rupa can never be infected by ignorance, can it? This can never be infected by ignorance. But your minds can be infected by ignorance. And boy, oh boy, is it an infection? It's a cancer. You've heard of lung cancers, you've heard of skin cancers, you've heard of blood cancers. Have you heard of mind cancers? You know why you haven't heard of that? Just imagine if you were all born in a mental hospital. Would anyone be talking about what's wrong with them? Would they? No. So why doesn't anyone know of mind cancers? Because everyone has it. That's why the Buddha was very unique. When a crazy man comes out of that craziness, having realized that he was crazy, with no help, that's special. That's what the Buddha did. He realized that he was crazy. And then having come out of that craziness, Then he discovered the path out of craziness. That is the Noble Eightfold Path. The path out of craziness. Because in this world of craziness, we create entities. Simple as that. Simple as that. I mean, just think about this for a second. You have a car, you drive your car. Someone else has another car, they drive their car. And you're driving along the road. Right? You have an accident. Say you just, the two of you bump into each other. As the two drivers get out of their cars, which car are they going to look at first to assess the damage? I rest my case. Which car? I'll close my eyes, you answer. Because, you know, now I know. As I say these words and you start thinking about them, you're like, oh God, it's embarrassing. Which car are you going to look at first? Of course, the obvious one. Why? Because it is my car. A car being damaged is a loss. It's a loss to the country, it's a loss to the economy, it's a loss. It's a loss. It's simple as that, it's a loss. So damage to which car is a loss? Damage to either car is a loss, right? So why do we look at our car first? Because there are two damages now. Not just the damage to the car, but the damage to my ego, the self, my car. So I am hurt. I am damaged. That's why you look at my car first. Whereas in reality, you should be looking for the car which has the most damage or the more damage and therefore address that. But you always look at your car first. If two children have had a fight and one's your child, I can give you 100 examples. All instances and examples of how the self has undermined you and belittled you and stooped you down to such a low level where you have become selfish. But you'll think of yourself as a good father, a good mother, a good son. Because you are selfishly selfless. That's okay. That's okay because that is a stepping stone to the next level up. Without the Dhamma, there's no way getting here. No way. Nope. There's no way of getting past this without the Dhamma. You can go to school and learn human values and become one of these. You can. You can learn about virtues. You can learn about Mahatma Gandhi and become like this. You can learn about Mother Teresa and become good. You can. It's good because we need good people in our world. But that's not great. Greatness transcends goodness. It is where you become a nobody. When you become a nobody, you are everybody. Now it matters not who's hurt. There's hurt. Now it matters not who has benefited. There is benefit. There's advantage. There's good. If there's some food left over, it shouldn't matter to you who eats that. You're hungry, someone else is hungry. It shouldn't matter to you who eats that. What do good people do? Well, first of all, what do bad people do? There's one plate of rice and two people are hungry. Right? What does a bad person do? What do they do? They say, hey, look at that over there. And by the time they turn back round, there's no more food. That's what bad people do. What do good people do? They might share. Yes, they might share. In sharing, what they do is they care about the other person. The sharing is caring, right? So they share with the other person because it makes them happy to see the other person is happy. That's what the good person does. To a great person, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whose hunger is sated. It doesn't matter whose thirst is quenched. It doesn't matter. Because all they see is hunger. So hunger needs addressing. Thirst needs addressing. Poverty needs addressing. The ill need treating. That's what a great mind sees, because a great mind does not identify characteristics as belonging to a particular individual. They don't see that goodness belongs to some and badness belongs to others. Have I not always encouraged you and shared with you something I do? When we drive past, especially Colombo and the urban part of the cities, you know, we see these big buildings, we see big houses, we see big cars, and I always rejoice in them. In my mind, I am always so happy to see that, because I know that it is through a good deed that someone has benefited from this. I rejoice in that. Because goodness need not happen to me, should it? Let's just say Nibbana was here, okay? And only one of us can get to Nibbana. So somehow the Buddha said, right, I've just brought you Nibbana, it's a pill. If you take it, you have attained Nibbana. Right? And the pill is here. It's in the middle of the room. If any among us feel that I should go and get it, trust me, you can only reach for it, but you can't grasp it. Nibbana is like that. You'll reach out for it. Right? It'll be a bit like this. You'll reach out for it, but you can never be able to. You'll never be able to grasp it. You have to be of a state of mind where you genuinely feel, if there's an ailing mind, may that mind attain it. If it is this, so be it. If it is that, so be it. If it is the other, so be it. Then when you grasp it, it'll come into your hold. That's how Nibbana works. If ever you are self-centered, ladies and gentlemen, Nibbana is a mile away from you. It's a very different thing. You know, that's why they call it, this is not worldly. That's why they call it Lokottara. There is nothing in this world that can describe what Nibbana is. Because the whole concept of Nibbana is out of this world. It is supramundane. It cannot be defined in terms of goodness and badness. Because goodness and badness are both part of this world, aren't they? But Nibbana is neither good nor bad. It is a premise where you can no longer define good and bad. It's like that. If you draw a line on the board, now you have left and you have right. Yeah? But if you erase this line? Now which one's left, which one's right? There's no longer left or right. That is Nibbana. But of course, this is the stepping stone. You can't be bad and get to Nibbana. You can't go from bad to great. You have to first shift from bad to good, and then from good to great. Your mercifulness, your kindness, your compassion. I think it was last week we talked about, no, it was in Saturday. Metta, Karuna, Mudita, and Upekka. And I briefly mentioned, you know, try and be as compassionate as you can. Try and have as much loving kindness as you can, because the definition of loving kindness is like the ocean. No matter how long I talk about it, I can never conclude, because it's so vast, and I myself have not understood what metta is, not in its entirety. It's like the vast space. You can't. But to whatever extent we strive to do that, we keep moving from bad to good. So whenever you give, that's why whenever you do a meritable deed, I always encourage you to do it, resolving in mind, may all beings attain Nibbana. Don't just think, may I attain Nibbana. May all beings attain Nibbana. Or you can even simplify it further, may Nibbana be attained. There you go. Because once you start thinking about, may I attain Nibbana, once again, You are taking a self-centered approach. May I attain Nibbana? May Nibbana be attained. Who's Nibbana? Exactly. May Nibbana be attained. Because in a state of Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen, there is no identity of a self. Nibbana is what a mind achieves when a mind begins to perceive that there is no such thing as an entity. There is no such thing as a self. There is merely the five aggregates. When a mind perceives that, that is a mind that has attained Nibbana. This is making a lot of sense, isn't it? It will. For some of you, it will make sense 10%. For the others, 20, 50, 80, 90, 99, maybe 100 to some. Maybe 110% for others. But that's quite all right, because we are all on a journey. To whatever extent this makes sense, try and internalize this. That's the beauty of this Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen. You know, to whatever degree you understand it, it's the internalization of that that takes you the next step further. It's like, you know, someone comes and asks you, there's a road. I can't see beyond that junction. What should I do? You tell me. You can see up to one point, but you can't see beyond that point, but the road continues. So they say, what must you do if you want to see the rest of it? Walk that far, right? You've got to walk that far. So if some of these things are not making sense, maybe half of the sermon makes sense, the other half doesn't make sense, then what do you think you ought to do? Internalize the half that does. Listening to a sermon and understanding is one half, but internalizing it is another. How do you internalize? By practice. There's no other way. Can you learn to swim by reading a tutorial? No, you can learn that, you can read the techniques, but it's when you get into the water, you start to internalize those techniques. That's the difference. I can teach you how to swim while we are ashore, but once you get into the water, then you realize, good Lord, it's a different kettle of fish altogether. Now you have to internalize the lessons you have learned. The same thing applies for Nibbana. And on that journey to Nibbana, the things I talked about this early in the morning, picking up that litter, you don't think that matters? Oh boy, oh boy. If that doesn't matter, I don't know what. Even when you walk me up and down, if I see a bit of litter on the floor, I'll be the first to pick it up. This is our world. This is not his home or her home or something like that. It's not my home. This is our world. In my mind, I don't separate. But when someone does, they leave the banana. The banana goes into this part of the world. The peel goes into the other part of the world. Someone else's part of the world. See? People who would never consider littering in their homes, they will freely do it when they're out on the streets. Have you not seen people pulling their windows down and throwing out stuff out of their cars? Please don't hate them though. They're not bad. Badness has gotten them. You get me? They're not bad. There are no such people called bad people in this world. Everyone's an arahant at the core. That's why you got to chisel it away. That's what the Dhamma does. I want you to start, I know you're already on that path. I want you to think of all human beings in that manner. People who love you, people who hate you. You can't have people that you love and you hate. You're not entitled to that. Have people to whom you serve your duty. People to whom you serve your duty. People to whom you serve your responsibilities. After all, you know, when people expect us to love them, what do they expect us to do? When someone expects love from you, what do they really expect from you? To sit by the side of a room and just say, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Is that what they expect? No, don't they tell you, show me that you love me? Don't they tell you to do that? And how do they expect you to show them that you love them? By fulfilling duties and responsibilities. So what does that tell you about their understanding of love? If you fulfill your duties and responsibilities, they will feel that you love them. Yeah? So what does an arahant do? He fulfills his duty and his responsibility. What am I doing right now? I'm doing the same. I'm fulfilling my duty and my responsibility. Now, I spoke of an arahant and myself in the same breath. Don't you be reading between the lines now. Please don't walk away with anything I haven't said. I have a long way to go before I become one. But I will become one by the end of this lifetime. That much I am sure of. Right? But I'm not for one moment suggesting that we are one. Okay? But I know the path to take to get there. I can see the end of this, the light at the end of this tunnel. I can see that. I can see how this practice will lead me there. That is what is it. That is what has entitled me to come and speak to you about it. That's why I can explain things to you so clearly, in a way that makes sense to you. I'm not just throwing you, you know, confounding jumble. I'm not just throwing you sutras from here, there and everywhere and just saying, you know, try and make sense of that. Thank you very much for coming. Good night. I only preach to you what I have practiced. I don't preach to you what I'm about to practice, because I don't know what that's going to look like. I'll preach to you what I have practiced. But this personal journey that each and every one of us are on, it is a personal journey. So picking up that bit of litter, it's all part of becoming an arahant, ladies and gentlemen. Please don't undermine any of those things. They're very important. Even at the monastery, when our little kids come to us, the first things we teach them, making your bed in the morning. That's the first thing they have to do. It's the moment they wake up, the bed has to be made. Not one wrinkle. Has to be made perfectly. And we tell them why. We let them put out. Who offered this bed to you? Our devotees did, they say. 7 years old. They know. They know the sacrifices that you're making. We teach them that. You know, sometimes lessons that maybe when we were younger, our parents never taught us. You know, we thought money grew on trees. I remember to this day why my father didn't buy me a bicycle. Even when he promised me that he would get me one when I passed my exams, and I passed the exams, but the bicycle never came. And then later on he would teach me, Putta, that's not how we get things. You have to be deserving of them. You can't just desire things. You have to deserve them. They're very different things, he explained to me. We have a 5-year-old at the monastery now. His family flew down from Australia. Both mother and father are doctors. 5-year-old, he has his brother with him who's about 8. They're both in Little Britain. Huh? I'll tell you what about that later, another day. We have a program called Little Britain at the monastery. That's a trailer. More about that later. It's our journey to taking the Dhamma to the rest of the world. Because we have to create an immersive environment. The reason most children in Sri Lanka, they can't speak in English is because they learn English at school, but they only learn how to pass an exam. The English knowledge that they need to pass an exam is all they acquire. For that, they need to be able to read and they need to be able to write. That's what they learn. But they can't speak. So they can't communicate with another person. That is because they don't have an immersive environment for that. So even in the classrooms, English is taught in Sinhalese. It's okay. I'm not suggesting that we have to change the education system. That's not my part to play. What I'm saying is, that gets in the way of us giving the gift of Dhamma to the rest of the world. And therefore, I'm concerned about that. So the children who come to us, we have created an immersive environment, and there are laws that govern that part of the world. So if you walk into Little Britain, you can't speak in any other language. You can only speak in English. And there are some young children who, you know, they're not very good in English. They struggle, but they volunteer. They can just about make sense. They can just about put a few words together and form a sentence. Sometimes half of their sentences make no sense to us. I don't think it even makes sense to them. But they try nonetheless. But you know what? They come up to us, 7 years of age, ladies and gentlemen, can you believe me? They come up to us and say, Swaminathan, sir, I want to try. Buddha, why do you want to try? I mean, because most children, they fear English. Most children, they fear English. You know, most children in Sri Lanka, if you give them the choice of not learning English, they would take it at the first opportunity. Most children would be like that because they're scared of English. All because of the colonial system that was being put into our heads and how, those who know it are better than those who don't and all that nonsense. It's just a language. That's all it is. It's a medium of communication. That's all it is. But we are changing that. At least within the four walls of our monastery. We can't change the world. But we can change the world for one person. That's what we're doing. So I'll tell you more about Little Britain another day. But there we have created an immersive environment. And so this child, 5 years of age, we have taught him where the bed comes from. So his teachers have taught him, Buddha, it's the devotees who offer this. Remember that it is not to you they offer it. Because who are you to deserve a bed for free? Who are you to deserve a bed for free? They walk up to us and ask us, Swaminanda, when you take alms at the monastery, why do you go and put it in front of the Buddha and worship the Buddha before you consume your alms? Because it is not to us they offer it, Buddha. That's why. It is not to me they offer it. They see the robe and they offer it to the robe. The robe is not mine. The robe belongs to the Buddha. This is what they call the Arihat Dhaja, the flag of the Arahant. I have loaned it. This is on loan. I have borrowed it. So therefore the offering is not to me personally. It is only because I am clad in the flag of the Arahant. So therefore do understand that we only receive these things because our devotees are devoted to the cause of the Buddha's ministry, to the Buddha, to the great Arahants, to peace, to Nibbana, to ultimate bliss. They are committed towards that cause, they are devoted towards that cause, and that is why you get a bed. So, my dear child, when you wake up in the morning, must you not remember that this bed belongs to the Buddha? So should you not make your bed so that if the Buddha were to come up to you and ask for a bed, you should be able to offer it to him? Would you offer a bed that is untidy? We ask this child this question. He says, no. How would you offer the bed to the Buddha? In that way, leave it. So that if the Buddha were to come up to you and ask for a bed, you can offer yours. Because ultimately, it belongs to him. That's how we use everything at the monastery. We have loaned them. The kuti that we are in doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the Buddha. That's why when we use it, we leave it better than we find it. Even if we walk in for the day, we will make sure that before we leave it, we sweep it. If there are cobwebs, we remove it. If a bed has not been made, we make it. If a bottle needs filling, we fill it. These are the makings of a gentle monk. I don't think etiquette is simply something that is required for people who live in the outside world. Do you? Aren't etiquette and good manners part of our lives as well? Of course. And we are setting an example for these young children. These are the children that you gave to the sasana. I'm sure you expect no less than the best. So they all learn that. If you ever get a chance to speak to Anagarika Mahatmyas, if you ever visit the Anagarika Rame, ask them to show you their hairbrushes. We check them. Randomly, we ask them to bring the hairbrush to make sure that they're clean. Now think about the hairbrush that you have at home. They have to be clean. And if they're not, what do? Yes? we remind them that they are daughters of the Buddha and they are the leaders of tomorrow, and that in their footsteps many young women will walk, and they have to be the pride of the sasana. That's why I tell you, this is a paradise. It's all of us who have come together to create that paradise. This is not one man's doing. That's why if they see a piece of paper on the floor, on the ground, everyone will be the first to pick it up. If they see it, they'll pick it up. These are the attitudes that we must all have, because they all help us on the path to Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen. It's not like living a well-mannered life is one and the life to Nibbana is another. It's not so. We see that these two things is a hybrid. Because if we can live a good, if we can live a respectable life, if we can always leave a place better than we find it, then others who will come that way will be impressed. Because like I said, there are some people who are first impressed by what they see. You see? They're first impressed by what they see. Then they'll sit down to listen to what we have to say. What did the chief of staff of the defense of the air, of the triple triforces say? As I saw you Swaminvanses and all of you walking in lockstep, I thought to myself, how come you have such discipline amongst yourselves? What is the secret? And so I want to listen to that. I want to hear that. And so he came down and sat down and started to listen to what we had to say. See, all of these things are important because we are human beings after all. We can think. We can think on behalf of another human being. We can think of creative and innovative ways in which we can help others. All of these things are important parts of a good human being. The Buddha always advised us, before you go on to become an arahant, become a respectable human being. Show compassion to all. Show respect to one and all. On one occasion, there was a monk who was walking behind the Buddha and he saw a man of a different religion. Having seen him, he spat to a side out of disgust. And the Buddha heard this. At that very moment the Buddha stopped, he summoned that monk. And he told him in no uncertain terms how terrible what he had done was. And he asked him to go and apologize. He said, how dare you in my sasana show disrespect to another human being? Is that what I have taught you as your teacher? But don't you see today how things are a little bit different? Just because we are monks, we are not entitled. What gives us that entitlement? That sense of entitlement that some seem to have? I don't like that. We are at the world's mercy. That's why we go with an alms bowl, begging for your leftovers. That is what the Buddha taught us to do. Beg. If you want a robe, beg. If you want some food, beg. If you want shelter, beg. If you're ill, beg. Does begging and a sense of entitlement come together? They're mutually exclusive things. When you beg, you are at the mercy of whoever has and whatever they're willing to give. That is why we never ask you for anything. Because I don't want the Buddha to come and scorn me and ask me ever, is this what I taught you to do? Remember, he was a great prince. He was the king of the land. Had he stayed on under his father, he would have gone on to become a great monarch. So even when he visited his kingdom, after having achieved to Buddhahood, he went round with his alms bowl begging. And what did the father say? Oh my son, what is it you're doing? You bring disgrace on our family. We are royals. We don't go begging. Please come with all your monks to the palace and I will feed you for the rest of your life. What are you doing? You're bringing us disgrace. And what did the Buddha have to say? Oh great king, he said. Not dear father. He said, oh great king, you descend from the royal clan, whereas I descend from the Buddha's clan. This is my way. This is our way. We beg. We are at the mercy of those who have. This is the sasana, ladies and gentlemen. This is the sasana that you cherish. This is the sasana that you support. I don't for one moment believe that we are the only people who are like that. I'm sure there are many places around the world, around the country, where people actually try to live the sasana. Not just mummify the sasana. Not just put it on a pedestal and talk about it. People actually try to live the sasana. There are many examples of that. I'm sure there are many. But that is the sasana that I invite you to preserve. Preserve it for posterity. Preserve it for the future generations. Preserve it so that your children will benefit from it. Preserve it so that one day when your child walks up to you and says, Amma, I want to eat ice cream and I really, really, really want it. What can I do? You will have two options. One, you can give him the ice cream. Two, you can teach him how to get rid of the wanting for ice cream. If we don't preserve the sasana, you'll only have one choice. And that is always the wrong choice. What evidence do we have? How many ice creams have you had by now? When did you put the full stop? It was always a comma. Always a comma. Always a comma. In the sasana you can put a full stop. This is the only place you can do that. From punya karma to kusala karma. The word kusala itself is to cleanse the mind of defilements. That's what kusala means. It's to cleanse the mind of defilements. To cleanse the mind of raga, dvesha and moha. Anicca, dukkha and anatta are the only three pills that can do this. These are the only three things that can do that. Anicca, dukkha and anatta is what you practice when you practice the Noble Eightfold Path. That's what you practice. Samma ditti is an understanding of anicca, dukkha and anatta. Samma sankappa is having thoughts in line with that. Samma vacha is having conduct of speech that is in line with that. Samma vayam is having physical conduct that is in line with that. Samma ajiva is having a livelihood that is in line with that. And so on. Samma vayam is your effort in line with that. Samma sati is having an awareness, mindfulness that is in line with that. Samma samadhi is contemplating on the Dhamma that is in line with that. Samma jnana and Samma vimukti is the realization, the full realization of what you started with. So it goes round in a circle. And once you go around one circle, you keep going round again and again and again. And every time this circle rotates, it cleanses the mind. It keeps doing it enough times, your mind is going to be freed of raga, desha and moha. Anicca, dukkha and anatta. Ladies and gentlemen, I promise you, this path is crystal clear to me. Crystal clear. There are no doubts on this path. None whatsoever. I speak with such conviction because I'm experiencing the results of walking this path. I wouldn't come to you and fool you. Why should I? When I know that what I give is what I get. When we first started the children's home at the monastery, the commissioner, the child probation commissioner, she walked up to us and she asked us, Swami Nansa, we've just come to meet you after having to visit another place where the children there had been abused. And by you know who. I'm not going to say who. So what trust can we have that this place is going to be any better? I said, Madam, my teacher has taught me that what you give is what you get. And I believe that 100%. That is my belief system. That is my religion. What you give is what you get. So if I know that if I know this teaching, if I know this phenomenon, if I know this truth, would I ever give something to someone that I don't want them to have, I don't want me to have? I would never. Would I abuse someone if I know that if I give abuse, I'm going to get abused? I would never. Would I take something away from someone which I would want for myself? I would never. I would only give someone something that I would also wish upon myself. You know, that simple principle, that simple philosophy alone, ladies and gentlemen, can lead you to a better life. If nothing more, what you give is what you get. Simple as that. And that's when she decided, okay, you get it. So then they went through the paperwork, all was in order, and we got approved. So in that children's home today, we shelter many young children who come to us looking for paradise. Because they may not have understood Nibbana yet, we don't ordain them. Because that's a change in lifestyle. Ordination is not an option until they turn 18. Even if they come begging, not until you're 18, because ordination is not what takes you to Nibbana. The Dhamma takes you to Nibbana, right? So as long as they have the Dhamma, what else are you asking for? In fact, at the monastery we have a rule. If you come begging for ordination, we don't ordain you. And why is that? Because you can't want anything, right? If there's someone who wants to be a monk, then they don't deserve to be a monk. Because they need the Dhamma to come to their senses and realize that now I have the keys to their happiness. Because if I am the one who's willing to ordain them, now I get to choose when they're happy and when they're not. How is that so? It shouldn't be so. So you're ready for your ordination when you come up to us and say, Sir, I have done what you have asked to do. I've practiced. I've learned the philosophy. Right? If you think I'm ready for it, in your own terms, in your own time. If the monastery needs monks, then may you ordain me. If the monastery thinks that we don't need any more monks right now, we are okay, then so be it. Because what we have learned from the Buddha is, once you become an arahant, you have apparently a certain number of days after which, if you don't ordain, then you pass away. But so far we don't have that problem at the monastery. No arahants yet. Right, so even if one of them becomes an arahant, then all they have to do is come and say, Swami knows I have become an arahant. Right? And if they say, please, 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 or any others, I might die. Then we'll know that they haven't yet become an arahant. Aren't I right? If someone comes begging to you and says, please ordain me, otherwise I might die and I'm an arahant now. Now they fear death. How can someone who fears death have become an arahant? They can come and announce the fact, I have become an arahant. Do as you wish. They might come at you and they might come up and say this, I have become an arahant. I feel now as an arahant I can render my service to the world. Perhaps people may not be willing to me as a lay person, but if you ordain me, then I might have a louder voice. That might create a good platform from which I can deliver the Dhamma. So, if you choose that to be, then let it be. That an arahant might say. And there's nothing wrong with that. Because you have to call a spade a spade. An arahant needs to know that a hammer can hammer. So that's another matter. Good God. So one young man came up to us and told us a few weeks ago, Swami Nahansa, I have practiced for the last year or so. I have learned the scriptures. I have learned the philosophy. If you feel that I'm ready for my ordination, then at your own terms, in your own time, I'm prepared to ordain myself. And that man was a man who drove me to Rajagiriya over the last several months. We had a similar one before, remember? So he has asked me to extend an invitation to all of you to his ordination ceremony. The date is... Can you confirm the date? Is it the 1st or the 6th of June? 1st of June, right? Thank you. On the 1st of June, Mr. Susit, as he was called, his brother is already ordained with us, his elder brother. His mother is Cecilia Sravika. You know, entire families, they come looking for paradise, we give them. Finders, keepers. That's how it works. I mean, see, ladies and gentlemen, whole families, you know, whole families, they become whole again. They heal. As families, this is a huge paramita energy. People who would have lived with each other for many, many births, and at various points in their life in samsara, they would have promised to each other, you know, let's do this together. Let's make an alms offering and let's all promise ourselves to attain to Nibbana. People who would have done things like that together, they tend to go on this path together and they tend to exit together. So both brothers are at the monastery. His brother is ordained by the name of Susima. Susima Handro is the Swaminathan who is in charge of Little Britain, by the way. So he looks after Little Britain for us. More about that later. But his younger brother, Mr. Susit, who was my chauffeur to Rajagiriya, who drove me safely so that you could have a sermon every Sunday, having completed his probation period as a postulant, he is now prepared to enter the sasana as a bhikkhu and take the gift of the Buddha far and wide. He's learning other languages as well. Actually, everyone at the monastery, each and every one of us, we learn an additional language. On Sundays, I have Spanish classes. Soon after the sermon, we go back and just take Spanish classes. In fact, I'm very happy to say that upon hearing that I learned this language, and there are several of our monks and Anagarikas who learn the language, a husband and wife couple among you walked up to me a couple of weeks ago and said, Swaminathan sir, we are happy to help you with that and we want to introduce you to their teacher, my teacher. So they are learning Spanish and they introduce us to their teacher. And because until then we were just learning off the books. We got some books from somewhere, self-learning. It works sometimes, it doesn't work other times. And we do our best. Because we're not in the habit of going and asking for people's things, but we always try to do what we can with what we have. And then when people see that this is worthwhile, they support. That's the way we work. So we build and then they come. That's what God told Noah to do. Right? He said, build the ark and they will come. That's what we do. We build the ark. We do it as best we can. So if you left it long enough, I would have started to do a Spanish sermon, but maybe none of it would have made any sense. Right? But then someone will be in the audience and they'll come up and say, Swaminathan, what did you preach? You think that's Spanish? I said, well, that's the best I can do, I'm so sorry. And then they would have said, right, here you go, we can give you some lessons, here's a teacher, right? Learn the language and preach to us properly. So a husband and wife couple who have been coming to the sermons for some time in Rajagiriya, they walked up to me and said, Swaminathan, we are happy to support you with that. And then they put us in touch with their teacher. And that teacher who's been so generous, he's promised to teach our monks and our Anagarika Mahatmyas and our Anagarika Mahatmyas, the Anagarikas, the Spanish language, so that we can learn the language and give the gift of Dhamma in Spanish. And as I explained to them, you know, you have not just put us in touch with a teacher, what you have given us is a passport to the world. You have gifted the Spanish people, you have gifted the Spaniards the Dhamma. It's not that they have given us Spanish. They have given the Spanish people the Dhamma. That's what they have done. You've got to look at it from the other side. And from here on, you know, for many years to come, even if they die young and they're born as devas, right, as they see one of our monks delivering a sermon to a Spanish audience, you know, many people come, ladies and gentlemen, to this country, right? Tourism is growing again in our land. Right, after the wars have come to an end and, you know, the economy is beginning to settle, whatever, tourists are beginning to come into our country. They feel it's safe. And then people from all walks of life, people from all parts of the world will start coming here. If they can just visit, pay one visit, because some of them, they come on pilgrimages. Some come for, you know, tourism, right? Whatever tourism, ecotourism, they'll say, spiritual tourism, they might say. If they can just pay a visit, like the other day I said, on the way back to the monastery, I see people who come and bathe in the Nachimale. Huh? On Sundays, that's a common sight. On the way back to the monastery, there are many cars lining up the road at Nachimale. And I often think to myself, if only they went another 500 meters ahead, they would have found a better stream to dip into, wouldn't they? Perhaps if they had the merits, they would become stream enterers. But they enter the stream at Nachimale. Why only enter that stream? Why not the stream to Nibbana? See, can you see, a lot is going on here. Now, you didn't know that until I shared this story with you, right? Just today, right? Because no one came up to you and said, you know what, I went to Swaminarayan's and I offered him Spanish lessons. No one does that. Because no one's here for credit. They're all here for merit, not credit. When you want merit, you don't need to go shouting off the rooftops, I'm doing this, they're doing this, he's doing it, she's doing it. You don't need that. Because the more you understand the Dhamma, the more you realize this I, he, she, it, you, they, these are all pronouns which are creations of ignorance. So then you become embarrassed to talk about the fact that it is I who has done something, it is he who has done something, it is my mother who has done this, my father has done this. There are many offerings that have been made at the monastery, ladies and gentlemen, but to this day there's not a single name anywhere. The whole monastery has been offered. None of us brought any of it with us. The only thing that was there was the land, right? Because before we came in, we had to save up for that. So we cut down on meals, we cut down on clothes, we cut down on everything as lay people, and we saved up for the monastery, right? So 30 acres of land we bought before we came to the monastery. And then from there, everything that got built up from that, from scratch, from the Dhamma hall, to the kuti, to the kitchen, to the toilets, everything was built up by people such as yourselves, like yourselves. But there's not a single name that appears on any plaque anywhere at the monastery. Because no one does it for credit. They all do it for merit. Today we have a Chinese teacher. So committed. He teaches us Chinese, does 2 lessons a week. We have a Japanese teacher. We have a Tamil teacher. Mr. Daniel is our German teacher. He used to be simply our German teacher and now he's an Anagarika. So teachers, be careful. Just as you will have it your way, we will have it our way as well. Because if you give, you will get. Remember, if you're scared of what you're going to get, don't give. What are you giving? The gift of Dhamma. You're giving Nibbana. So if you give Nibbana, what will you get? Nibbana. So if you don't want Nibbana, then don't give. Don't offer a single spoonful of rice if you don't want to attain Nibbana. I have warned you. As you line up outside to offer Swaminarayan's your dana, if you don't want Nibbana, I warn you, don't offer a single grain of rice because it will come to you. Because you can't decide what comes to you. That's not your choice. Otherwise, why would bad come to people? Who chooses that, right? You can't decide that. There's no chooser here. You can't choose. Things happen, that's it. But no one talks about what they do. The chairman of the school never came up to you and said, you know, it is thanks to me you have this college. He never did that. It is only from me you learn that this is all for free. Did they ever utter a single word about it? No. That's the thing. They're not doing it for credit. They just want to leave this world a better place than when they came in. So Mr. Susit will be ordaining on the 1st of June, and he wanted me to make an invitation on his behalf. If you are free on that day, which is a Saturday, as most of our ordination ceremonies are on Saturdays, just to make it easier for people to come, then you're all welcome. And just like it happened last time, the first bunch of people he's going to precept will be the Dharmishtha Rajagiriyans. Remember with Lokisarahandru? Yes? So he precepted you for the first time as a monk, and the same will happen with Susit, whatever his ordained name is, would be by then. We don't know that yet. So mark it in your diaries. If you are available on the 1st of June, you are all welcome. Welcome and give him to the sasana. You know, there's a lovely story that Guru Hamdru always says. I love Guru Hamdru. There's a lovely story that he says. He says, especially he mentions this in the ordination ceremonies, he says, it's like playing football. When you play football, there's one player who kicks the ball into the net. But is he the only player that deserves credit for the goal? It's a team effort, isn't it? What about the player right at the other end of the field who kicked the ball to his companion? And he who kicked it to the other person, and he who kicked to the other, and he's come past maybe 10 individuals, and then down to the 11th one, he's kicked the ball into the net. So he uses this analogy, and he says, we have all, in samsara, been mothers and fathers to each other. Yeah? So, anyone who ordains today has been groomed by all of us. It may be that on this occasion, in this birth, it is his biological mother and father who kicked the ball into the goal. But what about bringing the ball to the goal? We were all part of that, weren't we? That's why today, again, we have come together as a community. These are all samsaric transactions, whether you believe it or not. There's a reason why we have come together. We've all been there together. So therefore, what he says is, all of you standing here to witness this ordination ceremony, please, offer your son to the sasana, just as if he were your own. Because he is your own, it's just that it's a different incarnation. That's all. What a wonderful way to look at it. And which is the truth. It's just not a lie that we tell ourselves, it's the truth. So if you are there on the day, you can offer a son to the sasana. But be careful, what you give is, what you get. So be careful when you offer things to the sasana. If you offer, you will be offered. I have one last thing to do before we conclude for the day. Actually, two things. One, I want to show you the video. Can we get the video up, please? So this is our two Swaminvahanses who are currently in Australia, spreading the gift of Dhamma. And many of you, having got news of it, shared this with a lot of your friends and families, and many of them have benefited, and they're eternally grateful for that. So they've sent me a short video clip of the good work that they're doing over there for two reasons. One, they want you to rejoice in it because you have made it possible. They didn't buy the tickets, by the way. You bought that. They didn't buy their robes, by the way. You offered that. So you are just as entitled as they are to rejoice in all the goodness that they're doing for the sasana. So if you're ready, let's watch the video. The second reason that he wants to share this with you is so that you continue to share this good work with people that you know, your friends and your families who may be still out there, give them an opportunity to meet them and to sit down with them for 5 minutes, listen to a sermon, and make a difference in their lives. So they're in Canberra right now. You saw the dates up on display. And I think we've shared the dates in the WhatsApp group as well. You know, when you look at them and what they're doing in the rehabilitation centers, these are, you know, we're serving people who would not have had a chance if it were not for the Dhamma. Otherwise, you know, why would a center in a developed country, in a first world country, invite a monk to go and give a talk to them? Just think about it. What's the logic behind it? If they have the best science, if they have the best medicines, if they have the best treatments, and if they have the best resources, why would they invite a monk to go and talk to these people? Just think about it. It's because, well, you know the answer. They still haven't found the cure. Because an addiction is in the mind. It's a chitta that yearns something. When the mind is vexing, it will find a way. Remember what we talked about right at the beginning of the sermon today. If there's something you want, you will vex. And if there's something you vex for, you will somehow go and look for it. You'll find it. The thing is, none of these rehabilitation programs, despite the fact that they are done with the best of intentions, ladies and gentlemen, throughout the world, people put in many hours. They spend a lot of money doing these things out of goodness of their own hearts. Despite what they do, these programs are unsuccessful because they don't treat the mind. Because they don't understand the mind. Not the mind in the way that psychologists think about. Psychologists think about the mind in another way. They think it's connected to the brain. But the Buddha speaks about the mind in a very different way. He speaks of chittas. Attachment arises in a chitta. Attachment doesn't arise in any other part of the body. It arises in a chitta. The only way to cease that attachment is to cease the cause of that attachment, which is ignorance. Ignorance leads to attachment. Attachment leads to vexation. Vexation gets you to want something, and when you want it, you're going to have to get it somehow. You can detox the body. Yes, I get that. You can, you know, you can bathe them in herbal oils and herbal water and do whatever you want with them. But the mind still wants it. If you could detox the mind, then yes, that would work. That's what we are doing right now. We are detoxing the mind. Raga, desha and moha are the toxins. The Dhamma is the detoxing. I want you all to rejoice in all of this. You have no idea the profound impact, the profoundness of the impact that you are making on this world. You, we, together folks, we are making a huge dent in this world. Those Swaminansas out there, they could not have done that on their own. You have helped. People who are listening to these talks in Australia, they have helped. People who are connected with us from New Zealand, they have helped. The people in the USA, they have helped. People in the UK, they have helped. People in our own country, they have helped. Our villages, they have helped in whichever way they can. Some devotees, they don't have a penny. But you know what they do? They come and sit down and listen to the sermon. They have helped. It's incredible, isn't it? What we can do when we work together. So why divide? Why separate? Why disharmony? It can't be that religion is the cause of division, can it? If the purpose of religion is ultimate happiness, how can such a religion be the cause of disharmony and separation? It can't be. The two things are mutually exclusive. There you go. And I want you to rejoice in all that. In fact, the Swaminathas sent me that video. They said, Swaminathas, please can you show this to them? Particularly because I had mentioned about the Australian program tour on a previous day, and you had personally passed on the message to a few people, many people in fact, and they had visited the Swaminathas, and they were profusely thanking you all for passing on the message to them. And so our Swaminathas decided that you deserve a treat for that. So they wanted to put the video together and they passed it so that I could share it with you. They just wanted to share it with you, that's all. And one last thing. All of us together, we have all benefited from having a place to come here and do this. It has been almost a year. We would not have come together like this had we had this sermon at the monastery. Why? It's far too much of a trek. You know that the drive up there is not an easy one. But to find a location like this in a safe plus part of the city, a place where you can come up and park your cars, and to have people who really care about you, the chairman as well as his wife, who has been a great support. If I may say so, she's a Catholic by religion, but she's very supportive. Behind every successful man, you know, that is what they say, behind every successful man there's a woman. This would not have been possible if she would not have helped. If she would have gone against it. If she would have said, you know, this is a school, we are here to teach. Why bring religion into this? Why a Buddhist talk? These are the silent figures behind the capes, behind the curtains, behind the veils. We don't see them, but they are all contributing to this cause. If I had to name all the people who make this possible, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be talking to you next week when you come back. I'll still be talking. But these are the stories that you need to know so that you can rejoice in them. I'm talking about goodness. You need not put a name against it, but think about the goodness, the intentions. How people can be so willing to give up for someone else. So the chairman and his wife in particular, as well as a good lady who today sat next to him, the chief operating officer of the school, who looks after the whole school on his behalf. It's a bit like what I had to do for Guru Hamdru. A bit like it. Making sure that you're all comfortable when you get here. The halls are available. That our trusted supporter, Mr. Attanayak, is always there. And Mr. Anthony, he's always there for us. You've seen the devotion with which he comes and commits himself. Always here without fail. And you've seen the smile on his face when he comes and does it. He himself is not a Buddhist, but he's always here. Now do you understand that Buddhism has nothing to do with this? Christianity, Catholicism has nothing to do with this? Islam hasn't got anything to do with this? This is for one purpose and one purpose alone. We are united because we fight for the same cause. And that cause is not Buddhism. We are not fighting for Buddhism, ladies and gentlemen. There may be those who believe it, that it is their responsibility to fight for Buddhism. Let them. Let them do what they have to do. You and I, we are not here to fight for Buddhism. We are here to fight for ultimate bliss. If that is something you can buy at the bakery, let's all go there. I don't care where it comes from. Do you? Must it come from me? No. As I say, if it comes from the bakery, let's go buy it. But the truth is, it can only come from a teaching, and that teaching, it was the Buddha who happened to teach it. He's called the Buddha because he taught the path to Buddhahood. That's why he's called the Buddha. But he wasn't born by that name. He was Siddhartha. Upon becoming a Buddha, he called himself the Buddha because he had discovered the path to ultimate bliss, Buddhahood. So there are so many people who have made this happen. And from here on as well, that is how it's always going to be. Individually, we can achieve nothing. But when we unite, it's like the great ocean. There are only individual drops in the ocean, but together they form the great ocean. That is home to animals the size of whales. So on this occasion, on which we celebrate the 50th of these sermons, I'm honored and privileged to let you know and inform you that all of them, this is not my doing, by the way, all of them have decided to show their appreciation for what it is you have done, sir. So they have handed over to me a token of appreciation to hand over to you, to thank you for the goodness of heart and for the greatness of intention that you have shown us, for the mercy that you have had towards all of us, so that we could come here and practice in peace. Once again, it is not my idea. It is the Dharmishtha Rajagirians. So please, can you bring it forward? I would like to invite Dr. Harsh Alas to please come forward to accept this little token of appreciation from all of the people who you have paved a path and given them the gateway to Nibbana. Subhateva, Nibbana, Subhateva. This is a note that they have written to you, expressing their views and their appreciation for what you have done. Subhateva. You know what he said when I offered that to him? These people are crazy. I mean, you bring them up here for once in a lifetime and you want to give them something as a token of appreciation. You know what they have to say? Swami Nohansa, it's not me you have to appreciate. Swami Nohansa, there are some people, close friends of mine, who practice the Dhamma, in particular Mr. De Silva and his wife. He wanted me to mention them, and he said, these are the people who gave me the opportunity to take this opportunity to present the hall so that you can come along and listen to the Dhamma. That's what they're crazy. the one chance that we took to give him something, to appreciate, and he says, no, it's not me that deserve it. It is because of someone else I'm here. That's what I mean, folks. From this to this to this. This is what the Dhamma has done to people. The transformation that it has had on people's lives. Sadhu, sadhu. So to all, those I have mentioned, those I have failed to mention, those I forget to mention, those who seek no mentioning, those who wish not to be mentioned, there are those as well. There are those as well who seek not to be mentioned. May the merits that they have all acquired, may the merits that we have all acquired, in paving this path for many people who are here today, as well as those who will join us in the future, those who watch these sermons online, those who will be recipients of the links that you share to them, and then they go on to watch them online. This is a mission we have only just begun. This is the mission of the Sambuddha Sasana. The Buddha wished for this to last for 5,000 years, and we will make sure that it happens. Won't we? We will make sure that it happens. The Buddha need not fear, because we are here. As disciples who walk in his path, devoted to the purpose of Nibbana, we will make sure that it happens. So finally, from the bottom of my heart, and on behalf of all of us at the monastery, I wish to thank you all, and everyone, those who have done decorations here, those who have invited others to join us, those who have set the cameras up, the Anagarika Mahatyas, everyone, those who have been inviting the Swaminas to deliver the sermons, those who made sure the clock was here, so I could see the time. Those who made sure that there was a glass of water here, so the Swami Nuhasi could refresh himself whenever he was thirsty. All that. Every little matters. May all those merits guide us and lead us to eternal bliss. Let us take a moment to transfer the merits for today and bring today's sermon to a close. Okay. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by listening to the Dhamma, inviting the Swami Nuhasi to deliver the sermon, engaging in various meritorious deeds, creating a conducive environment so that all could come and practice the path and achieve the ultimate bliss. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves that we are incredibly grateful to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters, who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves to the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends and our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, and our teachers, as well as those who've gone the extra mile on our behalf, who've left no stone unturned to help make a better life for all of us, who've helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits may they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our forefathers and our ancestors, as well as members of the armed forces, as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives in natural disasters such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends to us, those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. Therefore, out of loving kindness, compassion and a sense of infinite gratitude, let us transfer all the merits that we have acquired to all of them. May they, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may these merits help them to free themselves from those woeful plains and be born in the blissful plane. May these merits help them to abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to finally resolve and determine to make use of the blessings and the merits that we have all acquired today to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Theranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnai datnva, dvesha ginnai datnva, moha ginnai datnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Raga gini niveva, dvesha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivan sapa labeva, nivan sapa labeva, nivan sapa labeva. Tunruvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen silu loka silu satyoma nibbana paramasukhen sukhita taravetva. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.